We are continuing our study of the doctrine of man or humankind, and we've been using so far Genesis 9 as a springboard for talking about the various social ordinances that God outlines there. So if you will, please turn with me to the ninth chapter of Genesis, and we'll review what we saw. If you remember, God created the world with Adam and made a covenant of works with Adam and with all the world in him. And this was a covenant of perfect, perpetual obedience, such that if Adam sinned, and he did, he incurred the curse just for one sin. There was no provision for forgiveness in the Garden of Eden itself, which is proven by the fact that as soon as Adam sinned, he was kicked out of the garden. And an angel with a flaming sword was placed in front of it. There were no second chances in that garden arrangement. But God was merciful, and he made a way of salvation through the promise of the coming seed of the woman in Genesis 3:15. But then we have a cursed world, a world that you would expect to be complete chaos, nothing but destruction and death, and it really trended that way very heavily all through the first chapters of Genesis. So God brought a flood almost immediately and destroyed the entire world. But then in chapter 9, we see how God really begins in chapter 8, but how God begins to make a covenant with Noah and with all of Noah's offspring. And so I have argued that this covenant with Noah is a covenant with a whole world, because we are all the offspring of Noah. And we can see it's with the whole world, because God says in verse 22 of chapter 8, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And so you see, it's about creation. So just like the covenant of works was a creational covenant, so this covenant with Noah is a creational covenant. Well, then we come to the specific social ordinances that are given to all mankind, not just to Christians, and this is what's key to understand. These ordinances are ordinances that God has given to the whole of mankind for good order, for the stabilization of sinful, fallen human society until Christ would come, and then ultimately for the salvation of all of the elect. And so that's the purpose of the Noahic covenant, stabilizing a cursed, sinful world for ultimately the purpose of the salvation of God's people. But look with me in Genesis 9, verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So that's about marriage and bearing children and by implication raising them. And then verse 2, the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they were delivered. So originally, apparently, Adam was friends with the animals. He wasn't killing them and eating them, that in the creation order, he ruled them in the sense that he was to provide for their well-being, encourage their societies and whatever. But here, they're delivered into Adam's hand to be killed. Verse 3 makes that clear. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave green plants, I give you everything. So here God gives the entire earth to Adam for his physical survival, which then I argued leads to every human form of enterprise and business. So exploration, mining, the production of medicines from animals, clothing, building of houses, everything, all the sciences and all manner of things of work, of every calling in this world is caught up in these couple of first two, actually all these verses. So marriage is a calling, parenting is a calling, being a child is a calling, which we looked at callings last week, and every form of business and human, legitimate human enterprise for the flourishing of society. Then though, if you look at verse 5, it says, and for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man, from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. And then verse 6 says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Now, some would look at that and say, well, that's just a fact. And if you kill somebody, you're likely to make someone angry and they'll kill you back. But we know that's not what it's saying for two reasons. One, look at the reason. For God made man in his own image. This isn't just the way things are, it's the way they ought to be. If one man kills another man, then his life ought to be taken. Why? Because man is made in his own image. That's the first reason. The second is, you can't see it in English, but in Hebrew, this word, by man shall his blood be shed, that shall his blood be shed is one word in Hebrew, and it could be rendered as a jussive, which we don't have that tense in English, but it's a command. By mankind must his blood be shed. And so since it can be read that way, and the grounding phrase implies that it should, almost all interpreters have said this is the ground of the death penalty. And not just the death penalty, but do you see what the broader principle is here? It doesn't say if a man kills another man, you should slaughter his whole family. There's an equality, an equal weights and balances principle here. Nor does it say if a man kills another man, you shall fine him severely or slap him really hard on the wrist or cut his hand off. So it doesn't say you should punish lightly, but equally. And it doesn't say you should punish severely or in an excessive, unjust way, but justly. And so what this is a principle of given to society as a whole. Remember, this is given to Noah and all of his sons and the whole earth. Given to society as a whole of what the law that we have come to call lex talionis, which is the law of the same. And you can see it in other places repeated, the same principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in Exodus 21, if you want to turn there, verse 23. It's the same idea. This is actually pre-Mosaic law, this principle. So it's not just the Mosaic covenant. Exodus 21, verse 23 says, but if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life. That's what we just saw, isn't it? If there's harm, you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And so this is the principle of equal weights and balances and justice. And if you look at Genesis 23, verses 6 and 7, just a couple chapters over, it says, you shall not pervert the justice due to the poor in his lawsuit. Keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. So here we say, do justice and don't tip the scales on the basis of a bribe or for personal gain. You see? So it's the same idea. We have outside of some of the Supreme Court, and other justice buildings, there's, you know, Lady Justice, who's standing with a blindfold and she has scales in her hands. It doesn't matter who appears before her. What matters is that the scales are equal. And this principle should apply to everyone. Now, this idea is given to society as a whole, but what it also has to mean, it implies something that Jesus teaches, which is, let's look at the teaching of Christ briefly, Matthew 5, Sermon on the Mount. These verses have been misunderstood, but Matthew 5:38, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, what he's doing all through the Sermon on the Mount, he's not laying down principles for all of society, but for personal living. How you live as an individual in the world. And what he's saying is here, you should not take justice into your own hands. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. That slapping and this context wasn't a personal injury. It's more like take off the glove and slap somebody across the face as an insult. So if somebody insults you, don't engage in violence with them. That's what it's saying. So don't resist the one who is evil in that sense. But Jesus is not saying you should not avail yourself of societal authorities to obtain justice. That's the principle all through the scriptures. Paul did it too. I mean, we could discuss that, where Paul availed himself of the Roman authorities to obtain justice. So we have clear example of that in the New Testament. So as this principle from Genesis 9 was developed of equal weights and measures and societal justice or civil justice to right wrongs, it was brought about in several ways. There was an avenger of blood, if you remember. Usually the way this worked was that if someone killed someone in your family, the family or the tribe would appoint one other person in that family to go get that guy who murdered someone. Now, there had to be two or three witnesses. That's also part of justice. Can't just be slanderous accusations. There has to be a clear establishment of the facts of the case, which was hard to do in a case of murder, actually. But you would rather let the innocent go free or the guilty go free than punish the innocent, wouldn't you? And so they would send an avenger of blood whose job was to go and kill that guy. But the society did it. It wasn't just this one person doing it. Later, there were other forms of judicial tribal justice. And then finally, we see national justice and courts and judges and kings. And so there's many ways. The Bible doesn't mandate a particular form of government, is what I'm saying. Instead, the Bible mandates the basis of human government, which is justice. That's really what the civil government's job is, to punish the wrongdoer, and we're going to see in a minute to encourage the good as well when it comes to this matter of justice. So what the subject today is the civil magistrate. What is its role? Well, we have a section in our confession where we confess what the civil magistrate's role is. So let's turn to that in page 673 of your hymnal, and then we'll see if the Bible supports the things that it says. Of the civil magistrate, chapter 24. Paragraph 1 gives us the basis of the civil magistrate. What is the basis of the civil magistrate? Or civil authority, which is given to all of society, but all of society, note, has to delegate it to somebody, or rather it has to actually be vested somewhere in some particular persons. So paragraph 1, chapter 24 says, God, the supreme Lord and King of all the world, hath ordained civil magistrates to be under him, over the people, and for his own glory and the public good. And to this end hath armed them with the power of the sword for the defense and encouragement of them that do good and for the punishment of evildoers. So let's start to think through this. First of all, notice God is the basis of the authority of the civil magistrate. How do we know that? Well, we see it already in Genesis 9. God is the one who establishes it. We'll see it in a moment. Let's just turn to Romans 13 and look at that. The New Testament basis here of this. Romans 13. Verse 1. Now, the background of Romans 13, if you recall, is that there was a Roman government, that had used to be a republic. It had a constitution, it had a senate, and was corrupted and taken over first by Julius Caesar, a military dictator, and then later by Augustus Caesar and others. Rome was tyrannically taking control of all of the nations around it. and it had become an empire of military conquest and military glory. It had taken over the nation of Israel and was cruelly oppressing them and taxing them unjustly. And then here Paul says to the Romans, the Church of Rome, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. Now notice the present tense. It just says there is no authority except from God. Now look, and those that exist have been instituted by God. You say, well, God didn't institute the Roman authority. They had a constitution. They violated their own constitution. They violated the Roman Senate. They overthrew the entire tradition of Rome. Now they have a tyranny. But what he says is that those that exist have been instituted by God. That is through his providence. Now, that's instituted in natural law as a matter of justice. That's what the authorities are supposed to be doing, executing justice. And yet, the civil authorities are ordained and instituted by God. But what is the purpose for, now it doesn't mean they're following God's purpose for which he instituted them, but what is the purpose for which he instituted them? Well, for God's glory and the public good. That's what our confession says. And that's also what Romans teaches. If you look at verse 13, it says, Romans 13, verse 3, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is authority? Then do what is good, and you will have received his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. So the point is, it's to promote, not it's to punish the wrong and to promote the good. So one other thing here to note is that the Bible everywhere teaches that anarchy, which means society without rule, anarchy against rule, an anarchist society is very bad. And it teaches that explicitly. You can hold your place in Romans 13 because we'll be back here in a bit. But if you go back and you look at Judges 17:6. It speaks of the state of Israel. Remember, there were judges who had a limited amount of power. Israel was drifting away from her God. And it says in verse 6, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what is right in his own eyes. Now then what happened is this. This is important contextually in Judges. We're not going to go through it all. But in my judgment, you can read this for yourself, but the next few chapters are the most horrendous in the entire Bible. What happens in Judges 18, 19, and 20 is a direct result of everyone doing what is right in their own eyes. That's the context. And we know that because it's bracketed on the other side at the end of chapter 21, which more wicked stuff happens in chapter 21. In verse 25 of chapter 21, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what is right in his own eyes. The last words of the book of Judges, anarchy, where everyone does, they express what is in their own hearts without respect to the rule of God through the instituted authorities. That's what was happening. And God condemns it and says it's very, very bad. So, why is government ordained? Well, we've seen God did it for his own glory. He does it for public good. Now, this is important. Government is not given for private good. It is not given to make you a better person. That's not the point of government. It doesn't do that. It is not given for religious good or for the promotion of Christ or Christianity. What's it given? The sword, which is an instrument of bloodshed. It is given the power of force. For a purpose, the purpose of the power of force is to punish the evildoer. And so those who harm others, and that's actually, if you go back, you look at Romans 9, which we just saw, what was happening in Romans 9 is Genesis 9, one person took the life of another. Well, what if one person takes the property of another? That's also physical injury, and the government comes and brings force and should encourage a society positively not to do such things, but instead keep your own property, you know, promote things like ownership and appropriate, you know, purchasing and keeping your own things and, you know, in order and such things. So the government should do both, promote that and punish the evildoer. What if one person assaults another sexually? What's in the same category of doing bodily, physical, outward harm, isn't it? Or what if someone, we've seen in the Old Testament, this is a debate in our society, but you see it in the Old Testament, it's debatable, but you can so destroy someone with your words that you cause them bodily injury or physical injury. It is certainly possible for that to happen. You can actually falsely accuse someone in court so that they're punished unjustly. Well, what's to be done for words that bring such physical bodily injury? Well, it should be done back unto them. That's the principle of justice. So what are the goods that are to be promoted by the government? I want to argue that one of the great goods, we've already talked about some, but one of the great goods is that government should protect liberty. I'm going to make a biblical case for this. First, the government should promote liberty because the Bible has a negative view of oppression and enslavement to government. And where do we see that? Exodus chapter 20, verse 2. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It's in the Ten Commandments. What was wrong in Egypt? Well, they were enslaved, horribly oppressed as a people. And that's the first reason. If you study the scriptures, the Bible has a negative view of government oppression, or frankly, oppression by anyone. Any powerful figures that are oppressing are wrong in the Bible. Second, so we're looking at why the government, a good that it should promote is liberty. Second, all people are made in God's image. Well, what does that mean? If you're made in the very image of God, you should be free to express the image of God. Why would some image bearers have the right or authority to enslave in an unjust way, meaning people aren't just paying off their debts that they owe to you, but to enslave, to coerce, to oppress other image bearers? It doesn't even make sense. All men are created images of God, and so no person should defraud or unjustly restrict the freedom of another. So what are some goods that civil government should protect? First, should not oppress. Second, or liberty is what I'm arguing. So first, the government should not oppress. Second, all people are made in God's image. Third, the Bible indicates that it's a good thing when the public approves of and accepts their government. That's a good thing, even in the days of the kings. That the Bible looks at that and says it's good when a public accepts their ruling authorities. And I want to show you this. If you look with me at Exodus 4, verses 29 to 31. And then we're going to look at the opposite. What happens when a people reject the authority of the civil government? The Bible has a negative view of that, or that the foolish governors who don't rule in such a way as to get the approval of the public. But if you look at Exodus 4, verse 29, it says, "Then Moses and Aaron," these were the leaders of God's people, "went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and did signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed." So it was a good thing for them to recognize the authority of Moses and Aaron. And when they had heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel, that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshipped. So here's one instance. This is a unique case in history, that's for sure. And yet I want to suggest that there's something right here already implied in the Bible that the people would see a goodness in their leaders. That's right and good. Actually, it's the only way leaders can lead long term. Tyrants are eventually overthrown. It can take a long time, but it's the Bible recognizes it as a good. But it might help to see the opposite. If you look at 1 Kings 12:15. And this is the famous story of Rehoboam and the division of Israel. The kingdom was divided. So let's start reading in 1 Kings 12, verse 14. It says, he spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Now notice what it says in the next verse. So the king did not listen to the people. You say, well, the king doesn't have to listen to the people. He's the king, right? He has all authority granted to him from God. That is not what the Bible teaches. What a foolish ruler, even a king, not to listen to the voice of the people. It's extremely foolish. The king did not listen to the voice of the people, for it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word, which was spoke by Elijah the Shilonite to Jeremiah the son of Nebat. And then look what happened in verse 16. And when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, what portion do we have with David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your house, own house, David. So Israel went to their tents. And then if you read the rest of that chapter, Israel divides. You have a divided kingdom because a king acts foolishly. And we could go on with this kind of a case, but the case that I'm making is that even rulers, the Bible has a dim view of leaders, the established civil government that robs the liberty of the citizenry. It has a dim view of that. And yet, the authorities that are established are God's true authorities. And so let's look back in Romans 13 and consider what this says. Romans 13. So it says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection. I want you to notice these two terms. They're the same in Greek. One must be in subjection in verse 5, and then verse 1, let every person be subject. Okay? Not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God. So they are servants of God. They are, notice the present tense, not just should be, well, they should be too, right? And yet, they are. Authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay all to all what is owed them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. Honor to whom honor is owed. So I did a lot of reading on what this means, and I read all different kinds of opposing viewpoints on Romans 13. I read the way it was interpreted in American history. I read the way that the two sides, especially during the Revolutionary War, handled this passage. I read how it was handled in the Civil War, which some of the same arguments were used. I read contemporary sources. I read David Van Drunen's last chapter. He has a chapter in his book, Politics After Christendom, in which he makes a certain case. I listened to Dr. Waldron, so Reformed Baptist. I listened to sermons by them and read their articles. Dr. Waldron has a fascinating section. You may have his commentary on the Second London Baptist Confession. It's in there. You can read that. And so there's different viewpoints. But at the end of the day, there's just a few possibilities. And the question is, who gives the right to the government to be the government that you have to submit to? That's one of the big questions. Who does that? And there's basically four positions. One says every individual does it for themselves. That wherever you feel like the government's out of line, you don't have to obey them. Because you give the right to the government to be the government. The other view, a second one is, and that view was very unusual. That's an anarchist position. Christians usually do not affirm that. The other view is the government has the right to be the government as long as a lot of people, the majority of the people, are agreeing that it would be. So there's a social contract theory. This says when the Constitution was instituted early in America, we're all under the Constitution because it was instituted. The counter-argument to that, though, is, well, most of us today have never, some of us have, but most of us have not sworn an oath to the Constitution. So why is there a social contract when I was just born into America? I didn't agree to be under that, right? That's the counter-argument to social contract theory. The other theory is the constant consent of the governed. So in other words, as long as the people agree to be governed constantly, then the government has the right to be your government. And so an example would be, let's say that there are some cattlemen in the Pacific Northwest who have certain rules about how they handle their cattle. They have laws and regulations among themselves. You know, if a cow runs away, here's what you do with it. If there's a property dispute, here's how we handle it, and on and on and on. So the same kind of thing happens with whalers, you know, when they're out at sea and they're doing their whaling historically. They're beyond any jurisdiction of any civil government. They just decide among themselves how to handle stuff. So this view says, though, what if then the civil law disagrees with these ranchers at some point or another? So the ranchers have their tradition, but then the civil law, let's say of Wyoming or somewhere, says here's how you should handle these things. And a new rancher moves into town. Who is that new rancher to obey? The law of the cattleman or the civil government? Well, this view that I'm articulating says you just follow the law of the cattleman. That's the real law. Civil government should only reflect the will of the people. Another way to apply it is if we're all, you know, going down Plank, and it feels like in town the speed limit's not 35. Everyone knows it's, you know, 40 at least, or 45 or 50. That's the real law. You can just disregard the thing written on the post, you know, and say that's not a real law. The public determine the law, and the public determine the government. So that is another view. So one, just to make this simple, one says you as an individual decide whether your government is your government and whether you should submit to them. The other is the majority of people decide, or a large number, whether the government is your government and whether you should submit to them, which sounds very, you know, Western and American. Problem is, I don't know how you support that out of the Bible. Like, I would actually, as an American, jump at that. Hey, that sounds great, you know? But it's not in the scriptures. It's a purely reasoned argument. Where do you get that? Instead, here's what the New Testament says with all clarity, and we'll look at other places, but here's the first one. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Paul didn't say if a bunch of Roman citizens start rejecting their authority, or even those that Rome has conquered, countervailing the traditions of societies like Israel, that because Israel's tradition is so different from the Roman tradition, we can just disregard all the Roman laws. Sounds very attractive, and but it's not what Paul says. Instead, he says, there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Now, of course, there's a limit. No Christian, this is the fourth view, or the third one. So the first one is the government's authority to exist comes from your own heart. The other one, it comes from the majority of people, or what a lot of people are doing in terms of their society. A third view is the government is the ground of its own authority. This is like that the government can do anything it wants. It has all authority. This is like the divine right of kings to do whatever on earth they please. Well, no Christian can agree to that either, because there's one God, and no one, no human being is free to break God's law. Not covenantal law. So I'm not talking about greet the brethren with a holy kiss or, any of the New Testament commands versus the Old Testament ones, the kinds that change are positive law. I'm talking about moral law. No government says you must worship Dagon. No, excuse me, you have no authority to do that. You have to murder all the firstborn Jews. I'm not doing that. Midwives, if you disobey, you're in trouble. Okay, well, we're still not doing it. So moral law, summarized in the Ten Commandments, is God's. We may not disobey God's law in order to obey man's law. So, but still, look at, do you see these words subject? I heard it argued in some of the things that I read that this word, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, only means to acknowledge a governing authority. Doesn't have anything to do with obey them. So that was a big argument that I heard. This word, there's plenty of Greek words for the word obey. Paul didn't use the word obey. He said, be subject to the governing authorities, which is to acknowledge that they are authority, but that doesn't mean you have to obey them. That was one major argument that I heard used. The problem is, if you look up that Greek word and how it's used to the rest of the New Testament, it's like, wives be subject to your husbands as the church is to Christ. So we just say, Christ, I acknowledge your authority, but you didn't say obey. Or, or wives, I respect, I accept that you, my husband, are my authority, but I'm only going to submit to you if we agree, You're my authority, yes, but submission only if I totally agree with you. You see? And you can see Ephesians 5:24, same word. Colossians 3:18, wives be subject to your husbands. 1 Peter 3:1, wives be submissive. James 4:7, submit therefore to God. Same word. Does that just mean acknowledge God's authority? I don't think so. Now, there's an important question here, and it's this. It's the American system of government. We're not under a monarchy, thank God. I believe that, this is my personal opinion, right? But I believe the American system of government is the greatest ever devised, if we can keep it going properly, It is a constitutional republic. That's based on the constitutions came out of the idea that there are fundamental principles of law that should govern a whole society, and that a man shouldn't be the constitution. No mere man is the rule of law. The constitution is a rule of law. No mere man can change it all by himself. A society has a central document. It's analogous to the Ten Commandments at the center of the nation of Israel. So it's the notion of the rule of law rather than the rule of men. Not only that, but America has done what many nations fail to do, and it has separated powers wisely. So what are our powers that are separated? At the federal level, at the state level, even at the city level, we're separating the powers. Well, do you know what the first branch is mentioned in the U.S. Constitution? Anyone know? Well, what? Huh? Congress. Because the framers believed that Congress was the true government. They debated long about what to call the president because they didn't want to call him a king. They didn't even want to give him something like prime minister. He's a ball handler. Like the president, what he's supposed to do is a will of the Congress, which is the body of the people. And so while he's important, way too important today, and it matters who's there, really what matters is that he does a whole lot less than he does, because the way to tyranny is a single figure who concentrates power in his own hands. All through history, that's how tyranny emerges. And the constitutional checks to executive power rest primarily in the legislative branch. And this is free. I'm just telling you this, but our Congress, at the federal level, has voted away its authority to the federal bureaucracies, right? Well, it's getting out of balance. It's giving too much power to one place. The way back is a strong legislature, particularly the Senate, to strip the authority from the executive. Now, some may say we're past that point, and maybe we are, who knows, but nonetheless, our American system of government is designed to divide up authority with checks and balances because of the sinfulness of human nature. And those who came to America from other places, it wasn't theoretical. They saw what would happen if you didn't do this. They were fleeing from it. These were the systems they were under. And so in the United States, our highest legal authority, which means submit yourselves to the governing authorities, our highest legal authority is the Constitution. But it's also, it is as individuals read it, but it's also as the court reads it. That's in the Constitution, is what it says. So if an official tells us to violate the Constitution, especially in cases where the court has already ruled, we're not required to obey any official that would tell us to do that. You see what I'm saying? So it's not just because someone says do this and they're an official and they're wearing rank that they have the authority to tell us what to do. But the key is that in our society, submitting to the government isn't submission to a mere official, but to a system of laws with the Constitution as the highest law. And if a governing official tells us to violate the law of the land, then disobeying them isn't violating Romans 13, is it? Because there's to be subject to the governing authorities isn't to be subject to a rogue official. You see? Now that gets complicated. There's sometimes maybe not simplistic answers to that in our society. And yet our spirit, here's a really important thing. Our spirit as Christians should be one of submission, not sedition. And that's not a typical spirit in our society. Our society likes a seditious spirit, but as Christians, we should be postured to want to obey the authorities that God has put in place. So that's Romans 13, but if you look at 1 Peter 2, which is also familiar, but it says something really similar, just to show you it's not in one place, it's not even just from one apostle, but there's multiple places in the scriptures that teach this. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. Says, it's the same word here, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Notice this is not a practical matter. It's not saying be subject just to save your own skin. Look, Christians, you don't want to be punished, do you? So be subject. No, it says be subject. There's a reason. For the Lord's sake, which means his glory. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, that tyrant, guys. That's the tyrant. Whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. Now, this is not talking about that the emperor is enforcing the Bible. This is talking about societal evils. So uprisings, you know, social upheaval. So social evils is what this is talking about. Things that disrupt, and really we would interpret it as are disordering what is revealed in Genesis 9, right? And even tyrants do that because it's to their own benefit. Even if they themselves are doing wicked things, they don't want a public in chaos either. So it's not like they have to be well motivated. They will, in fact, punish those who are disrupting society and praise those who are not. Verse 15, for this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. So why should we do societal good and not cause upheaval and tumult and disruption and chaos in society to silence foolish people? And then it says, live as people who are free. But Paul, we're under that emperor. But live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but as servants of God, honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the tyrant. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, and so on. So it goes on, and it gives submission as well. And here, look what it says to servants. Be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. Servants are to submit to unjust masters. That's what the scriptures teach us. Because God establishes authority, and it's ultimately about God. If you look at Titus 3, you see it again. Titus 3, verses 1 and 2. Now, this is Paul giving a pastoral exhortation, so it's a short letter. Paul is telling Titus, who's a minister of the gospel, a shepherd, himself, and it's just three chapters long, and look what Paul decides to tell him in just these three chapters. In the third chapter, he says, remind them, that is God's people, to be submissive to rulers and to authorities, and then it's real explicit, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle, to show perfect courtesy toward all people. For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by others and hating one another. But when the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared, he saved us from such attitudes and such pride and self-aggrandizement. And so this is what the scriptures teach us. There's even, if you will turn with me to Acts 23, I'll show you this, Acts 23. Acts 23, verse 1. So Paul is before a council. He's on trial unjustly. He's been falsely accused of things. And chapter 23, verse 1, looking intently at the council, Paul says, brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. And the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck? So he's telling this high priest, who has ordered something contrary to Roman law. And he says, you are a whitewashed wall. And then verse 4, though, those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? I'm sorry, Jewish law. Would you revile God's high priest? That's what Paul was doing, reviling. That's kind of minor. You whitewashed wall. That's called reviling in the Bible. Would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, ooh, I did not know, brothers, that he was a high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now, that's the Jewish people, right? And yet God has installed rulers. We just saw no authority comes except from God. And so we shouldn't, the point I'm making isn't to make a detailed application. I'm saying that there's a spirit that should exist among Christians, which is a spirit of submission to God, submission to one another in love, and submission to the authorities whom God has instituted over us. Not because they're always right, not because we agree with them, but for God, for His glory. We must never obey any authority. That is a civil authority, a churchly authority, a home authority, a husband or a father who tells us or leads us to break the law of God. We must never obey such commands. We must defy them in those cases. And those are the examples that we have in Scripture. One clear one is in Acts 4. It's familiar, but if you'll look there, Acts chapter 4, verse 19. Peter and John were before the council. The council told them not to preach the gospel. In verse 19 of chapter 4, but Peter and John answered them, whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than God, you must judge, for we cannot but speak of what we have seen and heard. And when they had further threatened them, they let them go, finding no way to punish them because of the people, for all were praising God for what had happened. For the man on whom this sign of healing was performed was more than 40 years old. And then you have the follow-up text to that in chapter 5, verse 29, where they're before the council again, and Peter says, we must obey God rather than men. That's a very important text. Notice he doesn't just say, we must obey God rather than the civil authorities. No, rather than any man, you must obey God. Because God alone is Lord of the conscience, and He has left it free from the doctrines and the commandments of men. It's what Christ purchased for us in the gospel. Jesus alone is Lord. Caesar is not Lord. Christ is Lord. But Christ rules Caesar and even installed him. So the Bible is very strong about such matters. I want to read you some more. If you look at Proverbs, it has a lot to say about our relation to civil government. Proverbs 16. Verses 14 and 15 says, a king's wrath is a messenger of death, and a wise man will appease it. In light of a king's face, in the light of a king's face, there is life, and his favor is like the clouds that bring the spring of rain. So with this, again, we don't have a king. We have a system of law and government, and so you would make that transfer here to the United States. Chapter 19, verse 12, says, a king's wrath is like the growling of a lion, but his favor is like dew on a grass. Chapter 20, verse 2, the terror of a king is like a growling lion. Whoever provokes him to anger forfeits his life. It's a fact, therefore unwise to do such. 22, verse 11, says, he who loves purity of heart and whose speech is gracious will have the king as his friend. Verses 21 and 22 says, my son, fear the Lord and the king. Do not join with those who do otherwise, for disaster will suddenly arise from them, and who knows the ruin that will come upon them both. And then chapter 25, verse 11. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver, like a gold ring or an ornament of gold. Is a wise reprover to a listening ear. So that's how we're to speak to one another. You also have, I'll just point out, though we're to never submit to any command to disobey God's good law. You know, some people have said, well, there's more to it than that. There's jurisdictional boundaries, which I agree with. So the government has jurisdictional boundaries that it shouldn't rule beyond. And typically an answer I've heard, or an example I've heard here is, the government doesn't have authority to come in and seize my children and train them, does it? There's a boundary there. And that's true, but I would submit to you, is that boundary not still God's law? It's not an arbitrary boundary. It's not a boundary we all just agree on together. Who's responsible to train our children? Honor your father and your mother. That means we're to be honorable fathers and mothers. Fathers, train up your children in the discipline, the instruction of the Lord. That's a matter of God's law. If the government comes in and takes my kids to teach them, then I have the authority I have the responsibility not to let that happen. Now, if I happen to believe that I can choose to delegate the training of my children to someone I believe is wise to do so, I have the authority as a father to do that. What I don't have the authority to do is abdicate because some other bully comes in and says, you have to do what I say in a matter that God has given us. So I would even argue that jurisdictional boundaries are bounded by God's moral law. It's not arbitrary. It's not just something we agree upon as society. Wouldn't that be terrifying? You know, Plato in his Republic taught that. And it was getting traction among the Greeks that they just take all the babies when they're little and they're all raised by the state. I mean, we don't rely on the philosophers. We don't rely on society or our individual impulses to make these choices. We rely on God. God determines the jurisdictional boundaries of the authorities that he has instituted through his law. Yes, sir.
Let's assume that this nation was founded at least with the influence of Christianity, a strong influence. So that originally the gospel was very, very important in the nation. We know that all men are evil. All men have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Over a period of 200 years, more and more the evilness of man has overtaken the government, which is, I think, a very normal thing to happen. And the materialism of the United States, which God so blessed us with, has become a god to all of us, to all of us. Now you get a God who says he's first going to judge the church. Judgment will begin in the house of the Lord. And we see the nations beginning to change, where the current government is not wielding the sword over good laws which were happening, for example, on immigration, on stealing. For example, now you can steal $950 worth of things in California and not be prosecuted for it, etc. They are beginning to call evil good and good evil. Okay, so now, if technically I can be doing, as a Christian, evil in the sight of the law. So my question is not all of this the fact that God is bringing judgment on the Christian church in this country? That's where I come to, and that's why I say you're going to have to correct me on it.
I mean, the whole book of Revelation teaches that God increases the degree of injustice and even tyranny in a nation to punish the wicked. But it also teaches in Revelation that believers should see that as a blessing from God, and that we should see it as his purification of his people. Yeah.
I agree with that. I think it is a purification of his people. And each and every one of us, I think this is why we prayed for revival in ourselves, revival in the church, because we need it, whether we understand it or not, we need it.
Let me also say this. This is Pastor Tom, okay? So just take this for what it's worth. There's a good book written by a Reformed Baptist, Crawford Gribben, It's on the migration to the Pacific Northwest. Lots of Christians who believe that everything's going to collapse and they're going to recreate society out there in Idaho and Montana. And he makes a case that actually what's happening in our society is kind of both extremes are making advances. That we have rolled back abortion more than ever. So, I mean, than anyone ever actually expected it could be done. And it keeps going. There's lots of legal decisions that are very much in the favor of what we would say we would want. And yet the other side is making equal advances. And so there's a polarization. It's hard to say that that right now you look at the situation, what is true is what I think amillennialism says is true. Evil grows right alongside the church. And there's a tension that develops. And so I don't know if you can look at the United States and say it's a purely one-sided. All is not actually bad. In fact, depending on who you are, and look, I'm not. Don't pitch me I am against, you know, false notions of racism and all of, you know, the critical theory that's pagan. I think it's wrong. But if you ask even a black Christian today, are things better or worse for you and your family today than they would have been 100 years ago, 50 years ago? They'll say, well, now at least I can drink out of water fountains and I'm not, you know, run off from polling places. And so is it better or not? It kind of depends. It's worse and it's better. You know? Is it overall better? I wouldn't say that. And yet we've always been in a fracas, haven't we, this country? It's always kind of gone back and forth. Has Christianity lost its influence more than in the past? Yeah, I think so. It has. And that's a major difference. Yes, sir.
In reference to the kings and authorities down through the ages, our God who declares the end from the beginning, probably the foundation stone or the turning point from removing the power from those type of tyrants was the Magna Carta, the 12, whatever, where they just couldn't arbitrarily take things away from people. Now that, it's moved forward, and our founders understood that they had to put something in place. So that's just my comment.
I just want to say this. My role here as your pastor is to teach the Bible, and I can apply it as far as the Bible requires application. But listen, there's a lot of complicated, difficult types of questions that are hard for anyone to solve and way beyond what I'm capable personally of solving or that the Bible addresses. We have a society, we have natural moral law, we have wisdom that has to be applied, and there's legitimate debates about all sorts of matters. And so I think it'd be unwise for me to enter into the fray of a lot of those types of questions, frankly. But I'll take any questions if you have something. Seth.
Would you say that when we look in the New Testament, like with Titus or some of the other places, and it specifically talks about, or Acts 23:5, where it says, not talking about evil of a ruler of our people, that that's really getting at the heart, that every command that God gives us is supposed to begin in the heart. So how we think about someone in authority over us and then how that expresses that self in word or tone really begins to reveal what's in our heart about how we trust God in his providence and how we are to guard ourselves against the increasing temptation and the growth of sin in our hearts by how we even approach things. So we may completely disagree. We may call evil the acts of rulers that are acting evilly, but we should be careful not to speak evil of them and also not to believe evil statements about them that can't be proven.
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely. We have to be able to recognize evil. Like I'll say boldly, as I've said before, abortion is a wicked, terrible sin. You know, we could line them up. There's plenty more we could talk about. You know, but when you start to have a seditious attitude toward governing authorities, that's, I think the Bible's correcting that. A spirit of rebellion Because that's not in just one place. If we're seditious toward human authorities at all, we're probably seditious to a lot more than other human authorities, and in all likelihood, it's toward God too. Someone else have one? Miss Deirdre, and then we probably have to close after this.
This is a comment instead of a question, but I appreciate your teaching on this. I know it's complicated, but I think as a whole, and you said this, but the idea of being subject and being submissive, I think as a whole, the church has lost the idea, the understanding of how to submit while still standing boldly for truth. Hmm. In the same way that we've lost the true understanding of what it means to love, which is not a warm, fuzzy feeling of what makes someone feel loved or what we think is loving, but to stand firm, humbly and kindly and gently, but boldly, for what is true and best. And I so appreciate that y'all teach us that, because that's what is so concerning to me today, is that we don't know how to do the right thing in the right way. We either do the wrong thing or we try to do the right thing in the wrong way.
That's a good insight. I think that's true. It's like threading a needle that you have to hold forth. You have to hold both tensions, right? Where you submit to God and your human authorities, and yet you have to stand for righteousness. And I didn't mention this, and I should have. There is a system, thank the Lord, in place in our nation to correct evil still. And I say we should avail ourselves of that system as much as possible and not just talk about it. I mean, you know, Facebook is fine, I guess, but that's not enough, is it? We have to deal according to the laws of the land. That's part of being a good citizen, and it's not easy. But anyway, let's close with prayer. Father, we thank you for your love to us, your mercy, your abundant and all-sufficient grace. We thank you that you are the God of all authority, and that one day every wrong will be made right, that one day you will be the one and only king over all your people, and that you are and will be a perfect ruler now and forever. And we gladly submit to you, not because we're coerced or subjugated, but because you've won us from our hearts to love you because of your first love for us. In Jesus' name, amen.